Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
We start every podcast with everybody's weird work moment of the week. Mine has been quite spectacular. Last week we had an update at 10 to 6, 10 minutes before we picked the kids up from nursery, to say that they would be closing that night for the foreseeable and for potentially 6 weeks. And then we got the official notice the day after saying it was officially going to be 6 weeks. So it's been the juggle of all juggles this week of childcare. Thankfully, my Bluebird clients and both in-house at Macro, they were just like, we work around you, and just made everything really flexible. But it's tested us on a million levels, to say the least. I'm still in it. You can probably feel my emotion.
Because it's not just about finding a new one, right? It's about they actually have to settle in it, into it. You know, it's like it's not just a logistical challenge. It's like an emotional challenge as well.
For the kids, and then what the hell has happened, you know, the worry around that. So yeah, it's been a roller coaster this week, which has made work weird on all levels. I was having a 10-minute drive power chat on email marketing with somebody, you know, just to get the conversation in. So yeah, I'm super grateful for everybody that's been flexible around my immensely weird week.
That's great.
What about you, Alice?
So mine is not so much my weird work moment of the week as my husband's, but it is super weird. So he was contacted by a recruiter, and the job actually sounded quite interesting and very much suited his skill set. And he spoke to this recruiter. They had a great conversation. She was like, oh my God, you'd be perfect for this. It sounds just incredible. It's quite, you know, quite a senior role, global, in this big organization with enormous financial responsibility and portfolio. And then at the end of the conversation, she goes, well, I have to ask you something now, and I'm terrified to ask you because this is usually what ends these conversations, and I've been trying to recruit for this role for so long, and you'd be so perfect, but I'm just going to ask. And she's like, what did you get on your A levels? Did you get 2 A's and a B? And he's like, I don't even remember what I got on my A levels. He's like, it was 35 years ago. So he looks it up and he's like, I think I got 2 B's and a C and an A or something like that. She's like, sorry, gotta go. Like, that's the end of the conversation. And we had this like hysterical conversation afterwards where I was like, are they going to ask you, like, were you born via C-section? Like, were you breastfed? Like, how far back does this go? You know, it's just insanity. But she said even the receptionists have to have achieved that level academically. Otherwise, they're not considered for any position in the company. So I just thought that was wild, and kind of the antithesis of the way that everything seems to be going in the workforce, that it's less about that sort of thing and much more about your experience and your personality and things like that. It just was a wild, wild thing. Very weird work week moment. So anyway, Amy, what was your weird work moment of the week?
I would say it was heading into my wife's prime, doing a talk around careers. So it was split into two assemblies, and yeah, just being asked, am I flower seller? Am I a mechanic? Am I a footballer, a tennis player, a gymnast? Do I get rugby tackled? The questions were just hilarious, but I absolutely loved it. The questions were very weird, to the point where the lady Catherine, who was running the whole day, getting lots of different people in to talk, there was one good question across maybe 20 minutes, and she was like, oh my God, amazing, Lily. Any more appropriate questions for Amy's job role? And they were like, oh, what do you like to drink? Just like, so
I mean, it's
funny.
Sweet, isn't it? Because it totally humbles you and kind of takes you down to their level, which is just
it was amazing.
Place to be. Cool.
Yeah, it was so good. I took a loser's medal in and I took a winner's medal in. And the loser's medal looked better than the winner's medal. And they're all like, wow. And I was like, that's actually a loser's medal, you know? And they were like, it's okay to lose. And he's just a bit like, don't really know that. That was weird, but wonderful at the same time.
Yeah, I bet. I love the story that you shared the other day, that because you were in your Red Roses kit and the dominant logo is O2, and they said, do you work in the phone shop? Like, completely missing the England rugby logo, which is just...
I mean, that says a lot about O2 and their brand penetration among young people.
Yeah, and the fact that kids don't miss a trick either.
They categorically don't, do they? They don't. Thank you for sharing that. So that's given some snippets into the world that you work in. So the second question that we ask all of our guests is, are you where you thought you'd be at your career right now?
Well, that's a very, very good question. It's really hard to answer.
It's okay to say yes, by the way.
No, do you know what? I actually think the answer is no, only because leaving university after doing the masters, I just thought my life and career was football and females, and now it's rugby, F1, and football still. So I never thought I would be someone that had multiple job roles in sport. I thought I was kind of just going to be in that comfort bubble of football.
Mm-hmm. So what are your current job roles at present? You're across three businesses, is that right?
Maybe more. I'll have to count on one hand now.
Go on.
So I am the performance nutritionist for England Red Roses, for the England Women's Senior Team, which is my... call it main role. So I work 170 days a year as a contractor for them. And then I work with the academy drivers and the pit stop crew at Williams Racing. So again, that's another contractual role where it's 17, 18 days a year. So again, split, and it ties in well and works well with rugby, which is the way I could obviously take up that opportunity. And then I have my own online nutrition business called Committed Nutrition, where I work with anyone from general population to elite female footballers, actually. And I work with race car drivers across F2 and F3 as part of my own kind of business. And then we recently launched last year the Female Football Nutrition Network, which is... it wasn't my idea. It was a guy called Dr. James Morehen, and he used to work for the Lionesses. He now works in rugby. We both do, which is... all a bit mad, actually. But my first love is football, and we just felt that there was such a gap in the market for support and resource for female footballers across the world, whether they're elite or whether they're just playing with their friends on a Saturday, Sunday. So we created an app, built everything, built a community, and I guess now we're just in that process of, it's a new business, 6 months old, we're trying to grow it. It's there, but growing it is the hardest part. Yeah, we're having some great conversations with people in like New York. We just signed up a team in Norway. But for complete transparency, it's new. And we thought that grassroots female footballers would have just jumped at the opportunity to pay £15 a month, £20 a month to be part of a community where you get access to me. You get access to seven other nutritionists every day. But it's kind of not worked out how we thought it was. And I think what we found is, at the moment, we don't think grassroots players are people that we need to target, even though we feel they need the most support. It's actually the subgroup of, like, they're not quite Manchester United, Chelsea, City, but they're Championship or they're top of the Northern Premier League in Norway, Sweden. So it's kind of... yeah, there's a gap there, and we're just trying to navigate how we can fit in.
So I think what's so interesting, well, there's a million things that are interesting about your career, but which we'll get into in a minute. But I think what's really interesting to me and what really excited me about speaking to you was the fact that you have effectively carved out a completely new market, because even those really premier teams in women's sports have not had the benefit of regular nutritional advice, support, and that sort of thing until basically you started doing it, right? So this is really a new field. And I guess I'm curious, just first of all, why is that? Why has this not been a part of that equation before?
Women's sport isn't as well funded as men's. And if we take football as an example, and rugby, there is a lack of resource. There's a lack of kind of manpower, and because of the financial constraints of, you know, let's just take Manchester United Women's Team, for example. They had a skeleton staff when I first started versus...
Sorry to jump in. Can you just give us, when did you join Man United Women?
I joined them in, that was my first ever job after I graduated from the Masters in 2020. So started as a placement student and then ended up in a full-time paid role, which was amazing. So going back 5 years, I was like a nice to have. And I think nutritionists are a nice to have. They never have been an integral part of the staff team. When you think of like a coach or a team operations manager. But now it is evolving. But going back 5 years, like financially, nutritionists, like if you're gonna, you're probably gonna buy a football player rather than employ a nutritionist or spend it on, I don't know, a better bus to take you to a game or something like that. So I just think a lot of teams across all different sports, and this could be a little bit controversial, they have women's teams to say they've got a women's team. So to tick that box of equality and, yeah, we've got a women's team. But then when you actually look at a lot of the women's teams, and that's not the same now in Manchester United women's team, like they've got way more staff and way more resource and way more money, but a lot of it is a tick box and the struggle is real day to day. Like the what you have access to is not what people think when you work at a club that is a name that people know. And even when I went to England Rugby, which was 2023, like that is one of the biggest names in world rugby, like the one of the richest unions in the world. And going in, again, a bit of a skeleton staff, but they were willing to invest. I was like, wow, like there's been not much really in the last few years. A bit of an afterthought or getting, you know, leftover supplements that maybe the men weren't using. And yeah, just that complete contrast of lack of education, lack of resource, and a lot of females not going through a academy system or any type of academy, whether it's football, rugby, maybe tennis even. Because when you think of the men and the boys, they get practical cooking sessions. They get a touch base from the age of 10, whereas that's not been the case for the past 10, 15 years in female sport. So you can imagine when players get to that elite level and all they've really had is access to social media or what the friends say, or so then you're like, wow, there's so much to do here, which is amazing for me because it keeps me in a job, but there's so much work to be done in that youth age group to build them up for success.
Can you pinpoint the gear change of when it went from tick box to actually taking this seriously? Because you guys won the league at United, right? Is that my memory right?
No, we didn't win the league. Got to the FA Cup final when I was there. They won the championship just as I joined. So they were the first time they'd ever been in the top league in the WSL, which is a Women's Super League. And the tables started turning when the Lionesses won the Euros, and where female football couldn't be ignored anymore. And yeah, they put themselves on the map, and I think they had to win to be recognised and for people to put their money where their mouth is, if I'm being honest. And it's just literally been on an upward trajectory ever since. And I think now being part of a rugby team, kind of I took the decision to take a sideways step. This year is the Rugby World Cup, the Women's Rugby World Cup, which this team can inspire a nation just like the Lionesses did. And it's in England that transition from being ignored and being a bit of an afterthought to winning the World Cup, which is the bigger goal. Imagine how much that can inspire females and young girls to play rugby or even just to watch it or play other sports. I don't know.
And hopefully get sponsors and, you know, other people that are like to take serious interest and investment into driving, I was going to say equality, but it's going to take a while to be equal, I suppose.
Maybe
not in our generation, but maybe for our kids and their kids. And I imagine being a part of that change is going to be quite huge. But you've had access to the men's team as well, so you can actually see the difference.
Yeah, and it helps that my business partner with the female network is the nutritionist for the men's rugby team. So any favours I need, like, you can't ignore me anymore. But no, like, all jokes aside, we're trying to align as best we can. Yes, they've got more budget around food, menus. They stay in Pennyhill Park, whereas we stay in a village hotel. But from where we were 18 months ago to where we are now, we're now having more lunches at Pennyhill Park, whereas it used to be one a week. So there is a change. There is more, you know, investment being put in. And I think the more we can try and be on par with the men in terms of what we provide, it's only going to benefit the females.
So is part of the reason for this lag also about the time it's taken for nutrition to really become something that people took seriously, right? So there's obviously the aspect of how well-funded the women's teams are, but also my understanding of the NHS, and I know you spent quite a number of years in the NHS, is that for quite a long time, nutrition wasn't really part of the solution, and it's actually becoming more so. Can you just talk a little bit about how that shift has happened?
Yeah, I think love it or hate it, social media has had a big part to play in people being able to see more nutrition content, good or bad. I think it being easier to access has really helped. More eyes being on what players are eating or what someone's fat loss journey or someone has transformed their life and they've changed their diet. Like, people can now see it. And yes, it can be very dangerous. I know that there are obviously negatives to social media, but I do actually think it's played a big part in the evolution from a sport nutrition side of it. Like, it's been huge. Nutrition as a whole, I just think more education has spread across the board, whether that be from, like, city councils, the government schemes as well. Like, they have put money into nutrition and public health. So I think that has snowballed over time. And then when you've got the Lionesses winning, when you've got female, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other sports other than female football and rugby, but just people putting themselves on the map, people are like, oh, I'm inspired by them. What are they doing? And I think it just has a nice snowball effect.
And the global wellness industry is projected to grow to $9 trillion by 2028. I think so much falls under that hashtag wellness theme. And just from, like, the corporate side as well, I think businesses and corporations are more aware of the healthy workforce, less sickness, offering more wellness packages as a part of their employee onboarding.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that. I actually got a call last week randomly, and I guess this is the beauty of being self-employed. Like, it's a roller coaster. Got a call last week to see if I had a day spare a month. It's always a day. And you're like, reel me in. But yeah, it was basically like that corporate setting of wellness and nutrition. And like, the offer was to potentially support, like, C-suite individuals who want to improve their productivity, their intention in work, like, get their output. And I think now, with different corporations really putting money into that, like, that is just a whole... It's just a whole different ball game, isn't it? And I think that is actually why a lot of people, you find, maybe when you get to a certain age, I don't know, maybe like 40s, you don't really see people like over 40 in my role, like hands-on day-to-day, in camp, 30,000 steps a day, just, you know, running on energy drinks and coffee. But they will take a step into that corporate world, because yes, there is more money in it, but the skills are so transferable to helping someone, you know, get a £1 million deal over the line versus helping someone win the World Cup. Like, habit change has still got to happen.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to say about your Fuel to Perform 6-week program, because I've just done it. And I hesitated because I didn't think it was for me, because I see Amy and I think, well, you work with elite athletes. I am not an elite athlete. I'm merely a mother full-time working. But that in itself is endurance performance and working in full time in an office or whatever it is, running your own business or businesses, that in itself is performance. It is high level performance, isn't it?
High performance, but just in a different setting, different environments. Cognitively, you've still got to make decisions. You're under pressure, there's different stresses, but it's just in a different environment. So yeah, high performance is across the board, whether it's football pitch, rugby pitch, racing an F1 car, or sitting in a boardroom and making big decisions.
What would be the guidance you give to businesses who have got, you know, these challenges of keeping your employee base fit and healthy?
Yeah, I think if anyone's on the fence to thinking about investing in something like that, if we look at sickness rates and retention of workers, like how do you, one, make your working environment a nicer place to be? How do you help your workers be more productive, like produce more, but not necessarily make them work more? I just think creating a nice environment around work and health and well-being is huge, like for that, like longer term. Surely investing will only benefit the company, but more so the people that work for you, be healthier in terms of like the stress levels and their output, but also being able to make better choices outside of work as well, and that spreading into family life and weekends is something that I see as like a massive, massive win.
And I know you've done some work with children as well and families around obesity and childhood. And I think what is quite interesting is actually if companies are providing that kind of education to their employees around nutrition, actually they can bring that back into the home and can use it as a foundation for the next generation of the workforce. Yes. And ensuring that they're healthy as they grow and come into an age where they would be at work. Just going back to the beginning, because I don't think you were always in nutrition, were you? That wasn't necessarily how you started out. Can you sort of talk us through where did this all come from? Was it sort of a childhood love for sport that spawned this career, or where, what was the sort of origin point for you, and then where did things go from there?
Yeah, so good question. So I was always a sporty kid, like always in football kits. I had a, you know, bowl head cut with the fringe when I was younger. That was me. And my love was football, and I got, you know, brought up in a, you know, family that loved Everton, and football was everything. So every Saturday I was playing with the lads on the field in where I used to live, and, you know, that was character building in itself for 10 years. And I think naturally nutrition was always something that I had an eye on, but I was never fully invested in. I always tried to eat healthy, but I didn't know what healthy was. So for, yeah, up to the age of 12, actually, until the rules changed, I had played with the boys' teams, and then I had to join a girls' team because you couldn't be in the same changing room when you got to a teenager. And then, yeah, it was then, took football a bit more serious until I'm going to say like 18, and then people start going out drinking. You feel like you're missing out. You've got FOMO when your friends are going out on a Saturday and you've got a game on a Sunday. And then you've got like relationships. And I was like, do I really want to commit to football? And I actually had the opportunity to go to Georgia in America. I had the scholarship ready to go, and I just didn't go. And people ask me like, why? And I actually cannot fully remember the reason. I think I went to Zante with my friends to think it over, and just never ever went. So yeah, like was that an opportunity lost? I don't know, but I wouldn't be where I am now. But in sport, I'm just going to go to university. Still didn't have a clue what I wanted to do, and didn't enjoy the process of university. And I'll be completely open and honest, I'm not an academic. I have to really, really graft to remember things, and I was never top of the class. I decided that if I'm going to go to university, I'm going to go the furthest point possible in this country and go to Dundee. And I'd never been to Dundee before. No offence to anyone that lives there or listens to this and has been there. I thought it was like this city because I'd been to Edinburgh, and oh wow, it was like such a poor city. And I was like, I can't live here for 4 years. So I lasted 8 weeks, left. Worked in Sports Direct for a good few years. Like I worked for a year and then went back to university in Liverpool and was like, right, I'm just going to stay at home, play it safe. And yeah, went to university, graduated, and then I was like, I don't really know what I want to do. But so I went into public health, and it was an amazing job working with overweight families in Liverpool. But as you can imagine, very frustrating, hard to create and help with change sometimes. And then I was like, you know what, I'm just going to let go of this part-time role and just go into coaching, PTing. I'd done that for like 7-8 years. And how I got back into going back to university was I was working with a young female footballer for Liverpool Girls, and she had this injury, and I didn't know why she had it. But she was like your typical like tall, gangly kid that done everything under the sun, like cross country, tennis, football. And I was like, why is she not recovering? And we always used to see it on a Friday. She used to talk about what Chinese she was getting afterwards. And I was like, could this be linked to food? So I'd done a bit more digging, ended up in who then was my professor on the master's course, Professor Graham Close. Went round to his house. Funny enough, he was like, we're watching the rugby. And I was like, I'm not watching the rugby, it's rubbish. We made food anyway, and then we got talking about how teenagers were at risk of stress fractures in the back or any other bones because they weren't eating enough and were expending too much. And I was like, wow, that is so interesting. So this person had a fracture in her back because her bones were now too weak to sustain what she wanted to do because she wasn't eating enough. And then I was hooked. I was like, how do I get on your master's course? And then kind of the rest is history. So that's kind of where it all came from, really.
So I'd love to hear more about that time that you spent working with families. What is your feeling broadly about the kind of nutritional context that people and families and the public operate in this country? You know, what are the kind of push and pull factors that create obese families or, you know, situations where it's really hard to change behavior?
I personally don't think there's enough done to educate families. Yes, sound probably a bit contradictory saying it because I was on an education program for that demographic, but, you know, that was a very small team in a small part of Liverpool that was trying to make an impact when there is a national crisis of obesity in this country. And I just don't think there's enough education in schools either. It had to be after school. And then that was a decision of the parents if they actually wanted to take the children after school. So I think more needs to be done in schools around nutrition. And actually going back to when I went to the school a couple of days ago, the teachers were pushing the message of drink milk and really trying to like showcase my job, because the area of Liverpool that we were in doing the talk was very, very poor. And that usually goes hand in hand with obesity, doesn't it? It is just a lack of education. They just don't know what they don't know. And that is, it's not their fault. Parents used to bring the children and we used to make things with them and just show them that actually this costs this much and the healthier version costs this much. And it's the same half the time. It's not actually that more expensive, if anything. And it was just like, oh my God, didn't know that. Oh my God, like how was I meant to know that? And it's just, there's a lot of habits, isn't there, that families have. And I think everyone, maybe bar a small percentage, recycles the same meals throughout the year. I mean, we usually have about 6 that you go through each week, 8 maybe. And like our approach was, you can keep your meals, but how do we just make it that little bit healthier? So we don't have to reinvent your whole supermarket shop because that is so overwhelming. But how can we take those chips off the plate but put homemade wedges on? It's still fish fingers and chips, but it's just that tiny bit better. So I think there just needs to be more care and more education given to that demographic.
So then how has that experience in the NHS and working with those families informed the work that you're doing now? Obviously, it's quite a big gap going from sort of poor families to elite athletes. But where is that through line for you? What have you brought from that job into your current roles?
I would say a lot of empathy. Like, it's easy to judge when you don't know what is going on. And from the outside in, some people might look at the families that we work with and be like, oh, they're just so lazy and they don't care about their, you know, sons, daughters. But majority of the time, it's they actually haven't got a clue how to be healthier. Like, where are they going to get their information from? Because if you go on social media, it's an absolute minefield. So I just took like a lot of empathy from that role, and just when you look at overweight children and their families in the in public health sector, and then when you look at elite athletes and gen pop, they're all human beings and they all have got a story and they all got a relationship with food, whether it's really complicated or just really easy. So I just think treating everyone as just the same and just understanding the whys behind why they picking that up in the supermarket. Do you think that's healthy? Same with an elite athlete. Why, like, some elite athletes I work with still now aren't confident going on a supermarket shop to get what they need to be an athlete. So people think elite athletes have got it all dialed in, like they haven't. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a job. So helping them make a shopping list and go and do it, and helping an overweight family to make a shopping list, it's just the same, but it's just the probably stress and pressures are just a little bit different.
Do you see a difference in men and women in the way in which they take advice?
Yeah. I can like hold my hand. I haven't worked with like elite athletes in the men's space in terms of like in a team environment. I've always been female. But I have kind of one-to-one and with Gen Pop as well. And I think the main difference in speaking to other practitioners in sport and things is men will just do it. They will just see food as fuel. And they're so programmed because of the years of education that they've had. They'll just do it without asking any questions, whereas females are so inquisitive and a lot of the time quite anxious around food and need to know, like, can I have it? Is it okay? Is this... A lot of the time I get asked, is this a test? I'm like, it's not a test. Enjoy it. But I think when you actually take those comments and, like, step away from sport, and that's probably what a lot of females think and have that relationship with food in a negative way, which is sad, really.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been there, right? As women, you just have such a complex relationship with food. It's there's so much emotion, and you know, the story of your life is wrapped up in this in the way that you feel about food at any given moment. And I think I would imagine that when you're trying to provide what is ultimately fairly straightforward advice, like do this, don't do this, this is what, here's a plan, try to stick to it. Right. It's actually quite logistical on paper, but there is so much, I would imagine, behind it that you also have to deal with the sort of psychological side of things with women and food. Is that right?
Yeah, huge. I always say it's simple, but it's not easy. Making something to eat is simple, but you actually doing that day after day after day within the stress of just general life, then it's often not just easy to do because there's so many temptations, isn't there? Like, and there's so many curveballs that happen. Like, you down with the nursery, and like, I'm sure that had an impact on your nutrition and how you have now probably got no time to plan food. And then there's the stress element, and then you start craving sugars. And just by one thing changing in the week can just shift everything. So, yes, it's simple, but it's not easy.
No, I've eaten my emotions this week. I could tell you that for free. And do you know what? I'm a very organised and planned person. And I think this does come down to organisation. And I'm talking about this personally, purely because I said it last night to Chris. We made it to yesterday until we got a takeaway, which was a miracle. And we've done something new in the past 2 weeks. We've written down and put it on the fridge what we're going to eat for dinner every day. And we followed it until we last night, we were, because yesterday was the hardest day. But that planning part of it has been a real game changer. And that, I think the link I'm going back to here is busy lives, working families, people working in-house, people running their own companies and managing families and all the curveballs that life comes with it. It's how much organization and having a plan does help. And then if you steer off the plan, you've got that to come back to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, and planning's boring, isn't it? I say it all the time. Like, you're probably bored of me saying it. Like, planning and prepping are just probably two tasks that people loathe. Like, oh, I need to think of what to buy for the supermarket. I need to think of what to make for this week. And like, unless you're a chef and you love being in the kitchen, it is so boring, but it's so essential to just being able to stay on track with whether you've got a goal or not, or just have that structure and repeatability, which makes life easier, especially with kids and being a business owner.
Okay, so you're in your mid-30s and you've got lots of your career left to go. You've already obviously had a lot of achievements in your life. You've built all these different businesses. You've founded different initiatives and things like that you've got going on. What do you want to achieve in the next 20, 25 years?
I want to be able to work hard. I think there's a lot of reward from that, even when you maybe don't know what the end point is. I would like my own personal business, Committee Nutrition, to get to a point where if I decided tomorrow that I want to move to Greece, I could take that business with me and be confident enough that we're okay, like financially, do you get what I mean? I want to build it to a point where it's overtaken elite sport income. And I don't have to rely on elite sport. But I'm not thinking of leaving elite sport like anytime soon. Maybe just getting to a point where in that next phase of life, when hopefully we have children, and then do I want to be away for a lot of the year? Probably not. Like, can I be in a role where I'm maybe, I don't know, head of a department or, I've just maybe got more things on my terms, longer term.
Your career would be what I described a sort of unconventional journey to get to where you are today. Some of the things you described around your education and the decisions you've made and how you've sort of evolved and switched and changed based on what you were encountering in your profession. What advice would you give to people who are trying to build this kind of portfolio career by the time they're in their 30s, where they get to do all these different things?
Be prepared to never have a day off if you want to build your business. Like, I don't really think at this present moment there's any such thing as balance. You just got to find a way to not smash any blades, to be honest, and just be organized and plan, because yeah, it's not a great day if you're not organized. But I think there's so much reward in hard work. Like, and I don't really have the full answer. I just know that if you want something, you just got to graft to get it. And I got to 28 or 29, and then I only had a light bulb moment that, oh, I want to do this. Being aware that some days you might move a mountain in business and in life and in work, and everything's going well, but some days you might literally move a pebble, and that's still okay. And that is the reality of life, isn't it? And business. And I think, yeah, if you just really want something, you just got to keep turning up.
Great. So one last thing then is that Dan and I are both obviously freelancing now. A lot of our work is not, running around doing 30,000 steps a day. A lot of it's sitting on our bums in front of the screens. What advice should we be focusing on from a health and fitness perspective to make sure that we're not going to suffer from that?
I think movements are so important in any form, whether that's going out for a walk once or twice a day, or it's going on a run or going to the gym, or gardening, whatever. Movement is so, so important. And I think from someone who is in job roles like yourselves, it's easy to fall into the trap of, oh, I haven't got time to go for a walk, or I feel guilty going. But I just think from a productivity standpoint and just getting outside, it's so important for health. And then also just in terms of general nutrition, it's just having more of a balanced approach to nutrition. So I think we all have that probably 2-3 o'clock slump in the afternoon. So it's like, okay, well, how can I have maybe more slow releasing carbs at lunchtime that don't give me that like peak and crash? And maybe just being aware of like what your daily habits are when you're working from home and when you're in the office. Because we can all fall into the trap of, yeah, maybe grabbing a biscuit when we're a bit stressed or we're a bit bored. Obviously, protein has always got, is always, whether your goal is fat loss, muscle gain, performance. Dan's probably bored of me talking about protein, but it's so important. If you're thinking longer life, like you want to hold on to as much muscle mass as you can to be able to age healthy and have that longevity. But then it's also important for satisfying your appetite and helping you stay balanced across the day with your appetite and not going on this roller coaster. So again, from that standpoint, I would say trying to just look at what your daily protein is and where the gaps are maybe to fill in.
Great. That's really interesting. I feel like the whole freelancer nutrition, health, and fitness field is as yet unexplored. Someone should write a book if they haven't already. how to keep yourself healthy while freelancing. Yes.
What does caffeine look like?
Are you pro caffeine or anti?
I actually like it. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
We say minimize caffeine after 2 p.m.
because
it will impact your sleep. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got my my matcha here because I've already had two coffees.
Nice. So.
Thank you so much, Amy. This has been really interesting. We could probably talk to you for ages and ask a million more questions. So thank you again. And yeah, really nice to see you.
Oh, no, thank you so much. And yeah, good luck with the pod. It's such a great idea. And I'm looking forward to seeing all the different guests that you've got on. And yeah, hopefully you'll be 200 followers on LinkedIn by
fingers crossed. Time.
Get to the next one.
Thank you.
We'll pop all your details in the show notes so that people can find out more.
Okay, have a lovely day.
Great, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.